This is Melissa, and today is the 13th of October, 2024. I hope everyone is doing all right. Friday, I played hooky from my work on a planned family outing. One of my brothers had learned that there was a museum, the Texas Civil War Museum, that was closing for good at the end of the month, and he wanted to go, so it ended up being all three of my brothers, my sister-in-law, and I, and we had a good time. It was interesting. It was educational. I learned, for instance, in the medicine display that the two most popular tinctures were arnica and gin. And I thought that made sense. If the arnica did not help with the pain, then the gin surely could. One thing that I was struck by was class distinctions that you see in the military from the enlisted man to the officer class, and how that's always been that way, I'm sure. They had the men carried these bags called housewives, and they were little sewing kits and all the things that you might need to do a repair, or, you know, just to have that thing that you needed. And of course the officers' housewives were quite nice. They were leather, maybe embossed, lots of detail. And the enlisted man would have a housewife that was just a little bit of fabric and some pockets to put the needles and thread and so forth in. Same thing with the haversacks for their rations and their supplies. The officer's haversack was a really nice, well, he might have a, you know, flat out picnic basket with a pewter or silver cup, but their haversacks were leather. They were nice. Whereas the enlisted man just had a cotton or linen looking haversack for his rations. And the museum had a really quite outstanding little collection of women's clothing from the period. And again, there were very few dresses that a common woman might have worn. They were fancier and really detailed, beautiful silk and sequins or appliqué. It was quite something, but class, the differences down through time. The redux that I am putting up today was suggested to me a couple of days ago by a listener. It's from September 17, 2008. In the Sovietized world, I'll always be me. Tracked to the grave, it's on my ID. Data retrieval made easy for authority, for people who care not for privacy. So listen not to the wise, nor to the bard. The sheeple will run for their new ID card. It is a good talk, and I know that this listener in Northern Ireland had it on his mind, quite possibly for some of the things that are going on right now in Ireland. And one of those is a protest that just happened a couple of days ago. And this protest, I know it was in Belfast, but it might have occurred in other cities as well. But this had to do with a new health bill that is going into effect. Hundreds protest in Belfast against new public health bill. Hundreds of people gathered in Belfast city center Saturday afternoon for a protest against the proposed public health bill. This comes after the DUP said earlier this week the bill has undermined public confidence. It has sparked controversy, particularly around vaccines. Opponents have expressed concerns that the public health bill would pave the way for unacceptably coercive measures in the future. So it goes on to tell you what the bill does and doesn't say and what the people's concerns are. But it is good to see hundreds of people out on the street. Alan started off this talk by saying, please go to the website and download as many of the previous talks as you can possibly manage. It takes a while to get through them. He said, I try and fit the pieces of this puzzle, this matrix reality, together for you and give you shortcuts to understanding because we don't have time to spend lifetimes in study anymore. We're on a roll into this new world order and all that it entails. So it's not set up that we can have fun and play for the rest of our days. It's set up to be a totalitarian regime where the betters of the world, those who are more evolved according to themselves, have the right to do with us as they wish. Yesterday, we had another book club live talk in the Telegram chat, Darren from South Africa and I, and we covered chapter 14. And we're getting a little smarter about it. Darren and I split the chapter. We both read it all, but we really focused on our segments. And knowing going in ahead of time with that, it allowed us to concentrate more fully on some areas. But I had gotten up early before the museum and started to type up my notes. And I got about halfway through typing them up when it was time to go to the museum in the afternoon. And then we had a nice bite to eat. And by the time I got home, it was early evening, and I finished typing up the notes. And at some point in the process of collecting the notes and making a copy of something out of a book that I wanted to read, I asked myself the question, what are you doing? And I meant it sincerely. What am I doing in this book club, reading a book that's over 1,300 pages long, that takes a tremendous amount of dedication and commitment to do it justice and trying to pick up the speed on it? So we're doing a chapter about every couple of weeks now, and it's a lot. And I was sincere when I asked myself the question, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And the book is educational, both the Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment are very educational. And I think specifically to see that there are groups of people who shape our world. They shape our political system, not just in England, not just in the UK, not just in America, but really this is a global supranational collection of circles within circles. So I do know why I'm reading the book, but I share that sense of urgency that Alan had for many years that certainly just got really picked up steam in 2020, but through the years, he said, we don't really have time to mess about anymore. And I know that even when he first started talking in the late 90s, he spent more time talking about esoteric and the mysteries and symbolism and some spirituality, that kind of, if you know, I don't know that he would use that word, but the beliefs, let's say, of the elite, as opposed to a truer, realer kind of acknowledgement of spirit. And he'd said to me years ago, you know, oh, he would be quite popular if he stayed with those kinds of talks. But there wasn't time anymore. And I know I mentioned this last week in last week's talk, that righteous indignation, that let him present things a little bit different. Let's talk about the same thing, the same groups of people, but let's give it to you just a little bit differently. And speaking for Alan, I will illustrate it with something else in the news, something else that is happening, something else that is taking away yet another of your rights. So that is where his focus went. And over the last few years, I am always asking myself, what is important for me to be focused on? And that's an ongoing question. That's an ongoing conversation. So in Tragedy and Hope, I think we're trying to bring you always, and I know that Darren does a good job of making parallels to what's happening right now. For instance, in this talk that we had today, or yesterday now, he was talking about Ukraine and Russia, and so bringing it into now. But that's where we are. We are watching over the last few years this agenda pick up incredible speed, and changes are happening too rapidly to keep up with. So again, as Alan said in this talk, right off the top, we're on a roll. We don't have time to spend lifetimes in study anymore. And that's kind of an alien concept, because human nature is human nature, and we just kind of, we do. The elite don't stumble along down through time. They plan very, very carefully. But we just bumble along. So that was it. That was it. That was Alan's point. Let's focus. Let's get up to speed and really quickly. But thinking, going to the museum and thinking about class differences and the rich and so forth. In my preparation for the Tragedy and Hope book club, I picked up a book that I read a couple of years ago, a biography of Bernard Baruch, an investor, a financier who had a big role in war resources and armaments in World War I. And I knew that this war resources board was mentioned and in that book, and it was also brought with a different name into World War II. So I opened up that book again, made a photocopy, and had that to talk about. But there was a name that jumped out at me in the reading, Tragedy and Hope, that I had not noticed before. And for some reason, I kind of fixated on this. The name was Edward Riley Stettinius Jr. He lived from 1900 to 1949. He was an American businessman, and he was the United States Secretary of State under Franklin D. Roosevelt and then Harry S. Truman, 1944 to 1945. And he was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations in 1946. I don't know why the year of that didn't leap out at me, 1946, because that really would have been founding time. But initially it didn't. But what did jump out at me in preparing for the book club talk was that he attended the University of Virginia, but he did not finish. He spent his time on charitable outreach to poor families. And he became a member of the Secret Seven Society. Later, he went to work at General Motors, There he started working on an unemployment relief program, and that brought him into contact with then New York Governor Franklin Roosevelt. The Seven Society was founded in 1905. It's the most secretive of the University of Virginia's secret societies. Members are only revealed after their death when a wreath of black magnolias in the shape of a seven is placed at the gravesite. I'll post a little link there and you can find out about the Seven Society. It's interesting. But again, in preparing for the book club talk, I realized that this Edward Riley Stettinius Jr. was the son, obviously, of Edward Riley Stettinius. So I needed to find out who his father was. His father was an executive for the Diamond Match Company. And after the start of World War I, he worked at J.P. Morgan and Company, coordinating the purchase of war supplies for the Allies. And then when the United States entered the war, he went to work in its War Department, so the War Department of J.P. Morgan and Company. So the war supplies is very important. This is like the most important part of the war because it's where our materials sourced and allocated, rationing of them, of important things like gasoline or petrol and oil and paper, metals, and so forth. He later became president of the Diamond Match Company. So you just, you know, like matches, so a big deal, whoop-de-whoop. But of course, that brings you into forestry. And the Diamond Match Company eventually spawned the Diamond Rubber Company. So again, we're talking essential resources. And just of a little neither here nor there trivia, the Diamond Match Company was purchased by James Goldsmith, who wrote the book The Trap about the dangers of free trade. And as it turns out, in this talk, Alan is talking about free trade. He's talking about NAFTA, which is now called USMCA, and free trade in general, and amalgamations, EU, the North American Union, which is still very much a thing. And also in this talk, Alan talked about the resurgent idea of world government. And this came from a Carnegie Council publication. It was their Ethics and International Affairs Journal. And it's interesting. I will let you listen to this yourselves or read it in the transcript. But that just made me think of John Kerry, and he made the news. So John Kerry, who's been secretary of this and that, he's now the climate czar. John Kerry of Skull and Bones. And he was at a World Economic Forum event this week. And the event, the World Economic Forum panel on green energy, investing, and sustainable development. And this is what John Kerry said at that event. It's an opinion piece by Jonathan Turley. If you want to know how hostile the global elite are to free speech, look no further than John Kerry's recent speech to the World Economic Forum. Rather than extol the benefits of democratic liberty versus dictatorships and oligarchs, Kerry called the First Amendment a major block to keeping people from believing the wrong things. The former Secretary of State, an aide to the Biden-Harris administration, told the sympathetic audience, "You know, there's a lot of discussion now about how you curb those entities in order to guarantee that you're going to have some accountability on facts, etc. But look, if people only go to one source and the source they go to is sick and, you know, has an agenda and they're putting out disinformation, our First Amendment stands as a major block to be able to just, you know, hammer it out of existence. So what we need is to win the ground, win the right to govern by hopefully winning enough votes that you're free to be able to implement change. Let me just scroll and see if there's any more that he said. Oh, the dislike of and anguish over social media is just growing and growing. It is part of our problem, particularly in democracies, in terms of building consensus around any issue. It's really hard to govern today. Remember Alan saying they're going to have to do an end run around democracies? So Carrie says, it's really hard to govern today. The referees we used to have to determine what is a fact and what isn't a fact have kind of been eviscerated to a certain degree. And people go and self-select where they go for their news, for their information, and then you get into a vicious cycle. Democracies around the world are now struggling with the absence of a sort of truth arbiter, and there's no one who defines what facts really are. Now, this opinion writer just went off on the ridiculousness of having a truth arbiter, and I will let you read this, but just, you know, my rewording of this is that what John Kerry just said there is, we've got to get hold of the government, right? So he said, we need to win the ground, win the right to govern, hopefully by winning enough votes that you're free to implement change. So I think what he just said there is, if we get the right people in, you're not going to have free speech anymore. We're just going to hammer it out of existence. His words. So this is what is going on as we slumber. But in looking at that old Stettinius Jr., I found that he had offspring who had offspring, amazing family of Stettiniuses, and they're all still in Washington, D.C., those who are still alive. There were two boys, twins, Joe and Edward, I guess, Ted. Ted and Sarah Stettinius, now as far as I know, they're still alive, and this Ted would be probably now about 60, I think. And Ted is a senior executive at IBM. He's done some other business kind of things, but I think that's what he's up to right now. I don't know what his wife Sarah does, but that's Ted and Sarah Stettinius. I know who they are because I'm looking at a glossy magazine called Washington Life. This is the 2014 edition, and it's their social list. The 19th annual record of notably social individuals from politics, diplomacy, business, philanthropy, and the arts. So they lead that list off, Ted and Sarah Stettinius. A couple of pages over is his twin brother, Joe, and Joe's wife, Regina, however they said that. Joe and Regina Stettinius. And Joe was also a businessman, CEO of some company. And his wife was a garden designer of, you know, like really big public space kind of gardens. I saw that Joe had a heart attack and passed away, I think at the age of 49, 50 maybe. He was young. His father passed away at 49. Or was that his grandfather? I think it might have been his grandfather. And then his wife passed away at the age of 53, just a couple of years ago. So they left behind a couple of children. But the point of this glossy piece here was to talk about what kinds of charity they're involved in, where they like to eat, what are the parties that they like to go to, what's their favorite charity. Their favorite charity was Boys and Girls Club and the DC Central Kitchen. And his twin brother, did they ask him what his favorite charity was? Groups like THEARC, I don't know how you pronounce that, and Fair Chance DC. There's so many different organizations impacting so many lives in our community. But this is about that. This is about their charities. And then right between the twins was the Belgian ambassador, Jan Matheson, and Agnes, his wife. And it was something that she said that struck me here. They asked the question, what do you like most about living in Washington? Now remember, he's the ambassador from Belgium. They're living in the beautiful embassy of Belgium, beautifully furnished, you know, gorgeous. What do you like most about living in Washington? And they answered, diplomatic life offers us exceptional insights and many opportunities, such as meeting the leaders of Washington's political, social, artistic, and economic communities. Plus, the quality of life is high. So I'll post this magazine and you can look at it and you can kind of get a glimpse at how high the quality of life is in Washington, D.C. This is what AllGov had to say about Matheson. He's a previous ambassador, Jan Matheson. Goes to say where he was educated. He got a degree in contemporary political history. He's married. He has 5 children. All of his different postings where he's been an ambassador. But what had jumped out at me is I saw some glossy book that his wife had done the photography for of the embassy in Washington, D.C., and then I saw their same names, and I'm like, well, how many Jan Mathesons married to Agnes Ertz are there? But they had done one glossy photo book after another of places, you know, lions on the cover, and you know, it was just an amazing collection of books. And I finally got the answer here. While he was at his different postings, Thailand, he was an ambassador to Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Burma. While he was there, he pursued his interest in wildlife photography and gardening, even redesigning the landscaping of the Belgian embassy in Bangkok himself. What I'm hoping to convey is the different species that is them and us. They live for, you know, Alan would call it the drinky poos and the prostitutes at these different meetings, but they some of these issues of Washington Life magazine are literally called balls and galas or party, party, party. This is what their life is. It's beautiful. The people are beautiful. They're well-dressed. They're wearing a fortune in jewelry, just flipping through the magazine here online. Oh, did you forget to get somebody a Christmas gift? Well, don't worry, because Tiffany has this little pin that you can get for whoever, and it's only $53,000. So this is who these people are. But as I was digging into the Stettinius family, I got to take a look back at Edward Stettinius Jr., you know, of the Seven Society, who was on the War Board Commission. And I found this article. As the UN turns 70, a look at its architect, Edward Stettinius. This month, this is in 2015, the world marks the 70th anniversary of the United Nations, an institution founded with the enthusiastic support of a Virginia man, now known as the architect of the UN. As a student at the University of Virginia, Edward Stettinius fell short on the academic front, too busy, it seems, to complete the coursework needed for a degree. He was president of the student government, he was the head of the honor board, he established a student employee organization that placed UVA students at Charlottesville Business, and he led missionary work up in the Blue Ridge. That's Jeff Legro, the university's vice provost for international affairs and a professor of politics. The room we're sitting in was actually a room he lived in as a student. This is the former Betty Booker's boarding house. And despite his lack of a college degree, Stettinius would leave Betty Booker's boarding house to play an important role in business and government. John Pratt, another UVA alum who was at GM, read about how he had established this employment bureau in the alumni magazine, and he was impressed by that, so he hired him, and within 10 years, Stettinius had become a vice president at General Motors. From there, he went on to lead U.S. Steel and to support President Franklin Roosevelt, who brought Stettinius to Washington, where he convinced Congress to aid the Allies before America joined the Second World War. Even though he had no diplomatic experience, he had very good relations with Congress and was very good at PR. Lend-Lease, of course, was very controversial. It was giving our materials to our allies. Army and Navy were upset about this. Hold it, we may have to fight. What's going on here? Stettinius was key to explaining the cause to the American people, that helping them was helping us, and so he was able to generate the support that made Lend-Lease so successful. After the war, he crusaded for a new organization that could draw countries together. Struggling with the war, they realized that they needed to struggle with the peace as well, and that they needed some kind of organization to bring countries together to discuss world problems and to work as hard for peace as you worked for war. Stettinius was known as the architect of the United Nations, and he would become this country's first ambassador to the UN after serving as Secretary of State. Like Roosevelt, he was an idealist. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Because none of his success had anything to do with the Seven Society. It's very interesting. Very interesting how it works for them. I just go back and I look at Alan saying that and I go, I hear you. I hear you. We don't have time to spend lifetimes in study anymore. So sometimes I'm sure that I sound a little frantic if I say, oh, don't go there. Don't look over there. Let's, you know, but I remember Alan. I remember Alan in 2020. And we really are on a roll. Take care.
Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on September the 17th, 2008. There's always newcomers coming in to this program on RBN and into the website, so I always advise them to look at the website, cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and download as many of the previous talks as you can possibly manage. It takes a while to get through them, but I try and fit the pieces of the big puzzle, this matrix reality, together for you and give you shortcuts to understanding, because we don't have time to spend lifetimes in study anymore. We're on a roll into this new world order and all that it entails. And it's not set up so it's been a fun and play for the rest of our days. It's set up to be a totalitarian regime where the betters of the world, those who are more evolved according to themselves, have the right to do with us as they wish. Now, I've been saying for a while that this Fortress America, as it was called after 9/11, a few years later, they called it Fortress America. This was a combination of the US, Canada, and Mexico's security systems to be totally integrated. And that pretty well has happened. And I said at the time, too, and long before it happened, that eventually the money system would also start to merge. And what we're seeing now aren't the death throes of a system. It's simply the big boys rearranging the deck to fit the new system of a United Americas. That's what we're seeing. And they started this back in the 90s with amalgamations and takeovers of from one bank to another as they lined themselves up. The big top economists, the ones that don't do the guessing, the ones who are into geopolitics, who are into the Pentagon and so on, those guys are paid big money to project the future because they know where we're heading and they don't make mistakes. So whatever's happening today was planned that way. And that's what FDR said. Anything that happens in politics or in society, you can bet your bottom dollar that it was planned that way. That's what we're living through now. And to merge the Americas, they'll be bringing in a new currency. But they have to terrify the public of those countries first, so that we will demand that they do something. And then they'll roll the agenda out and wipe the dust off it, because it was written years ago, of how they're going to solve this particular problem. That's how things are really done. And we certainly are on a roll towards it. We saw this happening with Europe. Now, why would anyone in the Americas, after watching the amalgamation of Europe and the creation of a parliament for the whole of Europe and the nations becoming basically colonies, subsidiary or provinces of the European Parliament, with the emergence of a new euro dollar, what makes the Americans think that it's be any different here? It's the same format, same agenda. And there will be a new currency that will be gradually unrolled once we've all panicked enough. And remember, too, money doesn't disappear when banks go down. Same in depressions, money doesn't disappear. It simply moves into fewer hands, along with the property and everything else. That's the beauty of those, for those at the top. They don't lose anything. They accumulate during times of crisis. Accumulation. And I'll be back with more about this topic after the following break. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix, talking about the amalgamation of the Americas and how they're proceeding with it. To the people, it has to appear as though things are just happening by circumstance and by accident almost day by day. That's what you're supposed to believe. But nothing, as I say, nothing on this magnitude of banks going under and so on happens out of the blue. Doesn't happen that way. Never did happen that way. And never will. It's a process getting us ready for the amalgamation. Remember, too, that money is a means to an end. If we all believe in money and are trained to go and earn money, not to go out and grow crops and survive, but to earn money, then the system keeps going. It's not our system. And that's the beauty of it. For the elite and how they regard money, you should look at Plato's Republic, because he gives a talk to an imaginary friend about owning property. And what he said is, if you, my friend, have a big mansion and a summer home as well, you have to have guards and servants. You have to replace parts that are stolen from your home, your valuables. You have to repair and upkeep it. It all costs money, and you're always worried about being robbed and so on. He says, isn't it much better to have the people pay for it for you, and they will pay for its upkeep and its repair and replace everything that's stolen? And if you look at how the elite live, they generally have trusts, big, huge family trusts, where technically they own nothing. But those involved in the big political game have all these different freebies and benefits given. In fact, prime ministers or presidents are really king for a day in the old style of Kronos. And they live like kings, but technically they don't own that place in which they live. This is the oldest game. It's the public that must believe in money. And sure enough, money, when it's withdrawn, can cause whole nations to collapse. That's the beautiful trick of it. Horror can result. Starvation can result. money is the key, not the ability to raise crops or farm. And then people still have their tools and their implements like their Great Depression, the last Great Depression. But it was a lack of money that stopped everything in its tracks. That's crazy when you think about it. Absolutely crazy. There were farmers plowing potatoes back into the ground to keep the prices up during the Great Depression. It's also been done since then. The European Union has what it calls butter mountains and sugar mountains and potato mountains. These imaginary mountains, in other words, surpluses, what they could call surpluses, that which would bring the prices down if it was put on the market. So they dump it in the channel, the English Channel. And they call this civilization. And they call it the best system they can come up with. But of course, that's their definition. That's also a big lie. Because they will take us into a new system eventually, and who knows how long it might be, maybe 30, 40, or even 100 years. But they will take us into a system where the state will issue credits to every single person and use them as a form of coercion to behave yourself and comply. And you will not be allowed to save them up like Lord Bertrand Russell talked about back in the 1950s. You'll start with the same sum every week. And if you were to buck the system, they withdraw your credits and you can't pay your rent, because in the future, down the road, after the many crashes that will come, there will be no private property. That's the agenda. It's interesting to look at the Freemasonic agendas of Albert Pike. He talked about the main enemies of humankind, and private property was one of them. And then you look at the Communist Manifesto with the same thing right in there. And yet, without property, you are technically a slave. You're at the whim of every master, whether it's a landlord or a baron over you. Whatever it happens to be, you have no say in your own affairs. And that's the reason that even when they started up the United States after the Revolution, they supposedly have said it was life, liberty, and the right to property, which was never put into the Constitution. If they did, they changed it. But they did discuss this and debate this, that the right to property was almost a sacred thing. Otherwise, you were a slave. And prior to that, every system that had existed had been a form of slavery. And talking about slavery, in all totalitarian systems, they always restrict travel. They must know what every citizen is doing. That's why they give you ID cards. In the 1990s, in the British Commonwealth countries, the governments of those countries tried to pass, and some did successfully, the full anti-terrorist bills under different names, but they're all identical. The one when Canada was passed by Alan Rock, when he was the Minister of Justice, and once he'd done his little job there, he was sent off to the United Nations because he is a globalist. And no one at the time could answer the questions, why is Canada putting through a martial law bill in 1998? They tried to do it in Britain too, and they tried to bring in the ID card in Britain in the late 90s as well. And people rejected this and said, no, nothing's happening, we're all quite safe. So 9/11 came along. 9/11 was a must-be. They needed this to bring all of this into effect. But Wendy Mesler, on the Wendy Mesler Show, CBC Canada, generally gets the big shows to introduce something. She was the one who introduced the HAARP, H-A-A-R-P project, to Canadians and the world. The one in Alaska, with Nick Bakage as the guest. But she also introduced the idea of the coming international ID card in the 90s. And she did a program on this, and she talked to one of the CEOs of the biggest companies, the one obviously deigned to bring in the card. And she asked the man, what makes you think Canadians will accept being tracked and traced and so on, and having to have this card to leave countries and get into countries and so on, and all their personal data on it? And he said, quite calmly, he said, because you'll be given no option. So if you think it's all to do with 9/11, You have to do your homework and see what was happening before 9/11 in the few years prior to that, because it was out in the open even then. And America being what it is, the US being what it is, and with the CFR and other organizations saying they'd have to do an end run, meaning going around the Constitution, they couldn't knock it out the way altogether and replace it, they just go around it and ignore it. And here's how they're introducing the ID card. This is from the New York Times, Wednesday, September 17th, 2008. This is a new license for more than just driving by Jennifer Lee. New York State on Tuesday began offering an enhanced driver's license, one of a number of non-passport citizen travel documents that are making their way down bureaucratic government pipelines. But it looks and functions as a license for driving. Only United States citizens can get the voluntary. See, they always start at voluntary. New license or the non-driver equivalent, which means it can be used for land and sea crossings to Mexico, Canada, and the Caribbean islands. These are the countries that are under the NAFTA agreement, where even right now, I think the Jamaicans and Trinidadians don't need technically a passport to come in, because that was already agreed upon under NAFTA. And really under the free trade negotiations prior to that. It says here, it's also a high-tech card equipped with a vicinity radio frequency identification chip that will broadcast a number to pull up biographic and biometric data for the border officer. Now, I can guarantee you this will be used all through your city as well. These are active chips, and they can be read too by the cell phone tower technology that's all over the place. It says, what is good for Easy Pass and Walmart is good for people too. That's the kind of slogan they're using. The same information that is in the front of the enhanced driver's license document is in the database, said Ken Brown, a spokesman for the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles. They're also sending out a sleeve out with the ID, he said. What it does is prevent transmission of that secure number. That's what you'll believe. This is part of the function creep around driver's licenses. The function creep around, end run, creep around driver's licenses that some people have long been fearing, push to make a driver's license a secure identity document as opposed to simply a credential to drive, has caused protests amongst privacy advocates and libertarians who warn that the licenses are verging on becoming a de facto national ID. Well, you know that will happen, because it happened with the social insurance cards. They call it the SIN cards in the Commonwealth countries. It's your social insurance number that was never to be used for anything except you're dealing with the government, do with your social insurance. Now, people hand it over everywhere, even in supermarkets. It says, numerous state governments have rebelled in part because of the cost. Federal standards for driver's licenses issued by the Department of Homeland Security. So that's who's running the whole issue. At the same time, a number of border states have been leading the charge for voluntary high-tech driver's licenses for other reasons, such as anxieties over how the border restrictions will cause economic drags and inconveniences. According to New York State statistics, Canadians make 2.5 million visits to New York State annually, spending $679 million. While New York residents make $1.7 million to Canada, spending $561 million. For many years, Canadians and American citizens were exempt from presenting a passport or other secure documents to cross the world's longest non-militarized border. That's the good old days. 5,526 miles over land and water. By God, things have changed, eh? I'll be back with more after this break. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix, talking about the ID cards that everyone shortly will have to have. And it's not just across the border either. You bet your bottom dollar on that, or whatever currency they give us, because this is going to be your ID card that will allow you into stores and out of stores. And we know from the British one, it's identical to the British one, same company that manufactures them. They have room in the card and the chip, lots of room for all your data, including your medical records, and will be used as a bank card as well. Can't buy or sell without it. Don't leave home without it. It says here in the same article, Washington State, which experiences a lot of cross-border traffic with British Columbia, was the first state to offer the enhanced driver's license in January. Other border states are working with the Department of Homeland Security, including Michigan, Vermont, Arizona, California, and Texas. In contrast, Maine has led the charge among states protesting the federal standards. And even Americans who do not live in one of the border states may soon be able to obtain a passport card from the State Department. And they show you a little makeup of one, not how the guy's name is, Happy Traveler. That's what they should call those who were communist sympathizers at one time, the travelers. This is a passport and card form that fills a demand by Americans for a less cumbersome citizen document to cross borders. There are also a number of trusted travelers identification cards that allow border clearance for low-risk, pre-approved travelers between Canada and the United States, whether by air, land, or sea. And it goes on and tells you how to apply for the card. And you have to pay for it, too. That's what gets me, how we pay for our chains through fees. We get fees to pay for everything. So the license costs $30 more than a normal driver's license or state ID, and is valid for 8 years. The price of a United States passport is more than $100. So, it says here, too, that the standards from these cards came from the Western Hemisphere, mind you, Travel Initiative, which came from the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, which you can actually download from this particular article. It's got a link to it in PDF form. You can download the whole Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act. This is requiring all travelers to present a passport or other document that denotes identity and citizenships when entering the United States. So, one way or another, you see, they get it through. They get it through because it's a must be, you see. In a world, this was discussed a long, long, long time ago, when they would achieve their global system, for government to exist, they must have enemies. And that's traditionally how they've kept themselves propped up in power and be able to tax people to protect you from those guys over there. When you run out of those guys over there, there's no more over there's left, and we're all global, then you have to find terrorism within. But you will find, because I've seen these things going up across or along the roads, they're putting various kind of these strange looking big fat poles up. They're big antenna poles with huge cables going into them as part of the technotronic system they're putting up. You're also going to find that you'll be tracked wherever you go. Wherever you go. And believe you me, if it's not encoded into that license that you can travel limitlessly, then you probably won't be able to move outside your own particular designated area in the future, whatever that happens to be. That's what's coming down. These guys aren't stupid. They plan all this years ahead and have it going through panels and debates and so on, one after the other. They know what they're up to. You know, global government is an old, old idea. An old idea first born in Britain about 500 years ago. John Dee brought it up. And then we find little associations, little fraternities down through the centuries afterwards, popping their heads up, called different names, but really all the same group, bringing up the idea of global government. And people like Weishaupt, Adam Weishaupt, talked about the creation of foundations and how they would finance the systems that they wanted into being through backing and promoting political movements or non-governmental organizations. Here's an article. It was from the Carnegie Institute. And again, the Carnegie, the Ford, the Rockefeller Foundation are some of the big ones in the United States. There's many more, mind you. They back these big NGOs that guide society along a preset path. And the general public follow, never realizing that the articles they see from these organizations in their media, never realizing that they're not governmental departments. A lot of people think they are governmental departments. It's like the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Every book they publish has a disclaimer in the first or second page saying this is a non-governmental organization and non-political organization. Even though they admit they give their ideas to government, ideas of where we should all go, to government. But they're right, they don't play politics, they don't play the game of politics, they simply write down an agenda and follow it. So they're telling the truth. Politics is for the little people to believe in. Here's an article they put out in volume 22.2, summer 2008, about the resurgent idea of world government. And I'll be back with it to read it to you after this break, trying to show you how we're not simply stumbling along some blind alley like a drunken man with a blindfold, but we're actually being guided and pulled and pushed and coerced along a particular path, a path chosen a long time ago by those who'd already found that they could control the world through economics primarily and through governmental institutions and the takeovers thereof, through fraternities working together, and people who are sworn, who swear oaths to each other to fulfill their missions in life, their quest, as they call it at the top, the Knights of Lover quest. And how guys like Adam Weishaupt, who was a bit too much open with his sarcasm and disdain of the ordinary person and fell into dismay with his peer group, but nevertheless he did say that we shall create foundations which will guide the world along this path, and sure enough they do. This article is from the Carnegie Institute, one of the big ones that fund a lot of the different NGOs, but they also have think tanks working on their own specialities, and they call it interdisciplinary resources for scholars, students and policy analysts. And what they do is set up what they think should be the policy of governments, and they hand it to the governments, the ones who make the policy, or at least sign it into law. You know that the Amalgamation of the Americas was drafted up by one of these non-political organizations, one of these NGOs, the Council on Foreign Relations. That was on Canadian television in 2005 when the Prime Minister of Canada and the US and Mexico signed it at Waco. The CFR came on as the CFR for a little news brief that they were giving out, admitting that they drafted it up. Quite something. That was really nice of them. It saved us the trouble, right? So here's a Carnegie Institute from their magazine, and it's called Ethics and International Affairs Journal. This is volume 22.2, summer 2008. The Resurgent Idea of World Government. Ethics and International Affairs, volume 22.2, by Campbell Craig, July the 7th, 2008. The idea of world government is returning to the mainstream of scholarly thinking about international relations. Universities in North America and Europe now routinely advertise for positions in global governance, N-A-N-C-E, a term that few would have heard a decade ago. Chapters on cosmopolitanism and governance appear in many current international relations textbooks. Leading scholars are wrestling with the topic, including Alexander Wendt, perhaps now America's most influential IR theorist, who has recently suggested that a world government is simply inevitable. While some scholars envision a more formal world state, and others argue for a much looser system of global governance, it's probably safe to say that the growing number of works on this topic can be grouped together in the broad category of world government, a school of thought that supports the creation of international authority or authorities that can tackle the global problems that nation states currently cannot. It is not, of course, a new idea. Dreaming of a world without war or of government without tyranny, idealists have advocated some kind of world or universal state since the classical period. They call it utopias. And as George Orwell said in 1984, and also in Animal Farm, he says some are more equal than others in such utopias. Italian poet Dante viewed world government as a kind of utopia. The Dutch scholar Hugo Grotius, often regarded as the founder of international law, believed in the eventual formation of a world government to enforce it. The notion interested many visionary thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, including H.G. Wells and Aldous Huxley. In 1942, the one-time Republican presidential candidate Wendell Willkie published a famous book on the topic, One World. It's an interesting read. And after the Second World War, the specter of atomic war moved many prominent American scholars and activists, including Albert Einstein, the University of Chicago President Robert Hutchins, and the columnist Dorothy Thompson, to advocate an immediate world state, not so much out of idealistic dreams, but because only such a state, they believed, could prevent a Third World War. Now, it's easy to go along with that for those who are going through all of this, war after war, and living on your nerves, to believe that it would be a natural thing to come about, obliterate nation states, and you would have world government, and somehow we'd all go to bed safely at night. But of course, that is utopian, because the ones who gave us the wars are the same ones and fraternities, like Carl Quigley said in his own book, the ones behind the wars, and he admitted the organizations behind, the ones that he knew of, were the actual organizations that he was a historian for. They're the same guys who are running us into their world order. It said here, the campaign continued as late as 1950 when the popular magazine Reader's Digest serialized a book by the world government advocate Emery Reeves. At the same time, the Senate Subcommittee on Foreign Relations was considering several motions to urge the Truman administration to adopt a policy of world federalism. In fact, to this day, the World Federalist Movement, an international NGO, non-governmental organization, founded in 1947 and recognized by the United Nations, boasts a membership of 30 to 50,000 worldwide. By the 1950s, however, serious talk of world government had largely disappeared. The failure of the Baruch Plan to establish international control over atomic weaponry in late 1946 signaled its demise, for it cleared the way, as the plan's authors quietly intended, for the United States and the Soviet Union to continue apace with their respective atomic projects. What state would place its trust in a world government when there were sovereign nations that possessed, or could soon possess, atomic bombs? Certainly neither the United States nor the Soviet Union was willing to do so, and once the two states committed themselves to the international rivalry that became known as the Cold War, the impossibility of true global government became obvious, and the campaign in favor of it diminished. Now that's not really true. You see, again, that's from the layman's point of view. Because, you see, the Soviet Union was financed into being and kept alive during its whole lifetime by the Western countries. We fed them. Canada and the States exported most of its grain there, all through the Soviet era. They were the biggest purchasers. And, like they said, some of the authors have said, big authors and for big books have said, and this was also came out of the Reeves Commission with Senator Norman Dodd, which is up on YouTube, by the way, him telling the story himself. He said that the intention he found out from the big foundations was their job was to guide the world along a path where the Soviet system could be merged completely with the American system. They call this the third way, or the third wave, as Toffler would call it. So we're guided along this path, and to those who lived through the eras where they've been threatened to be nuked any day, it all seemed quite logical that nations couldn't handle it anymore, and therefore why not give it up to some altruistic organization like the United Nations? That's how they see it, very naively, and that's how they're meant to see it, because the United Nations, going further back to the League of Nations, its precursor, stated quite clearly at the outset its purpose was to bring in global government. Read the article that H.G. Wells wrote about the League of Nations as world government, written about 1919-1920. It's quite the eye-opener. And you'll find, if you go into these foundations, look at what their mandates are, look at all the different specialized think tanks they have working on different projects. Projects that are all intertwined, as they call it themselves, they're completely interdisciplinary. All the disciplines are brought together That's science, commerce, health, everything brought together. Tremendous organizations, massive organizations, and all Masonic organizations, like Weishaupt said, love a foundation on which to build the great foundations. Now we'll go to the callers now, and we've got Kyle from Connecticut. There, are you there, Kyle?
Hi, Alan.
Hello.
Isn't it amazing how every dictator or conqueror has always wanted to rule the world, and they're finally have it within their grasp?
Yes.
And I think your listeners should be more worried about the passive RFID tags than the active ones. The active ones that we carry around are our cell phones, the perfect plugging device, but in Connecticut here, they're putting passive RFID tags in our inspection stickers.
Mm-hmm.
And they could read thousands of tags per second up to 30 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And track us up and down the highways.
Some news for people in Canada and the States, even your little ID cards that you have with the strip on the back can be read remotely from a good distance away. And they have been read remotely whenever you've gone into any government building for the last 10 or 15 years.
and they have the ones you can write to also within 10 feet.
That's right. So you don't even have to swipe it. The trick was to get us all thinking you have to swipe it through a machine, and we don't think any further. We don't think beyond that. That people have proven, in some cases recently in Canada, because they've been phoned back at their homes when they go home, even though they never gave their names while in the government buildings, they've been phoned by that particular agency when they got home, which meant their card had to be read when they were in, even though it's in their wallet or their pocket. Yeah,
and I mean, I'm just going by numbers that are for the commercial market for manufacturing.
Yes.
I'm sure they have higher technology that we don't even know of, and I really appreciate you covering the tough issues, the chemtrails, and this police state monitoring by RFIDs and eugenics on a daily basis, because not enough people know about this.
They don't, and people are now at that decision-making time that either will want to know, or they're going to total denial and anger if you present it to them.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
The one thing that confused me, I know the doctors are just practicing eugenics on us on a daily basis, and they want socialized medicine, but their symbol, the staff with the two serpents with the wings at the top?
Yeah.
What does that represent?
Well, supposedly they take it after the story of Moses, who had to take his men or his people through the valley of the serpents. Now, it's all allegory for much, much deeper things. But he made a brazen serpent, but on the serpent they claim that he had wings on it too. And that symbol allowed him to pass through what was basically an area where the secret societies ruled. That's really what it really meant. Then they have a whole story in the Talmud as to what happened to that staff afterwards. But also, it's interesting that sometimes they use the double serpents going round the same staff, which is just like a double helix of, when you look at the double helix and genes, and which leads you to think that science goes way, way further back, as I do believe, and I don't think they're just discovering things as they go along. I don't see why they'd catch on to that symbol to do with physical human health thousands of years ago, and here they are using that symbol today on ambulances and so on. Yeah. So certainly to do, I think, with genetics. You've got to understand, too, that medicine is heavily involved. Medicine really came through, along with surgery, through the wars. They were on the battlefields. That's where they learned a lot of their stuff and treatments, etc. And the Red Cross, which, again, is a Masonic-led organization. That's why it's a Red Cross. The Templar's Cross is just altered a little bit, its logo. They also use, and of course, the John's Ambulance Brigade also use the serpent with the helix on it. So this has always been used to do with health down through the many, many thousands of years, the same symbol. It also, a serpent, of course, is Lucifer. As Pike said, the Luciferian doctrine, it meant lucid thinking, pure rationality, pure intellect, etc. Through science, they would conquer. So that's basically what it represents. The serpent's always been a symbol of wisdom, intellect, and basically no emotion. The old symbols in ancient times used to, in fact, you'll find this in the Christian religion, pictures going back for thousands of years. They will show you in stelas and paintings, and the very old ones, Jesus on the cross being lifted to heaven with a serpent wrapped around him on his way up. It means much, much more, because he stood for all that was physical, but also love, emotion, all the human attributes, kindness, forgiveness, where the serpent is the opposite. It's pure rationality, it's Mr. Spock, in other words. Whatever is logical is what is done. And so the two come together in completion in the mystery religion.
And I've noticed just all the different religious groups that adopt different pointed stars.
Yes.
And I've only been able to see up to a 10-pointed star. Nothing over that yet.
Yes. And even that's rare. The 10 points is the binary code, of course. That's the key of 10, is the binary, the male, the female. It also stands for matter, antimatter. It stands for all opposites. And so 10 is very important. Washington, D.C., if you would say D.C. in the French, you'd have 10. That's why it's called D.C. And so they always give you these symbols in front of your face, which most folk never recognize.
No, like the Statue of Liberty on an 11-pointed star.
Yes. Yeah. And 11, of course, is reduced always down to 2, you see.
So...
But it's, yeah, everything's always in front of your face. They do love symbols, and they do have a religion consisting and a language of symbology and numerology, and then levels within the language and the alphabet, different levels for the higher degrees, as opposed to the lower ones too.
So we're definitely a lot older than we think. This 2,000-year history is just the new age.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt at all. I mean, even when that the story of Atlantis in Egypt from Plato again, and his uncle Solon going to Egypt, when he's told there have been many civilizations that rose to great heights and then fell down through the ages and were lost in time. But you take go into India and the histories of India, and they'd blow Darwin out the water every time on ancient civilizations where humans were still humans. We were not dragging our knuckles along the jungle.
Yeah. All right.
That's how it goes. But thanks for calling. And I'll be back with another caller right after this break, trying to put the big picture across in a few words, because we don't have time in this day and age to give a complete education anymore. We're on a roll, and there's so much you'd have to really learn. We don't have to know everything. It's a matter of reading the right books, and suddenly everything falls into place. And you realize we're being guided along this path that we didn't decide upon. We just go along for the ride because everyone else is going along for the ride. That's how most people act. What's everyone else doing? They're all stumbling along in this direction, and you stumble along too. That's how the sheep are supposed to see it from that level. And of course, the elite who run us and give us the media want to keep us thinking that way as well. Now we've got Joel in California. Are you there, Joel?
Yes, I am, Alan. How are you?
I'm keeping hanging in here, yeah.
That's great. Well, speaking of books, that was one of my main questions here. I actually have two, but I heard other callers talking about there's a reading list that you have, and I looked all over cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and I couldn't locate the kind of list of books you should look out for.
Okay. I do have it here. I'll see if I can retrieve it and put it up there for you. And mind you, once they're up, you have to grab them quick because people catch on pretty quickly. They're in demand and the price goes high. So if I put it up, grab it very quick and put your orders in to whoever's selling them.
Okay, great. Yeah, there's an old bookstore closing down here, and I zeroed in on an old H.G. Wells Outline of History. I got volumes 2 and 3, so I know they have more stuff hiding in there, so I want to try to get a heads up on what to look out for.
Yes, you'd be amazed. I found some amazing things in junk stores, just junk stores, because they buy stuff in job lots when people die, and I found some incredible gems in junk stores, in old boxes, and some of them were one-offs. I haven't found other copies, in fact, anywhere else.
Oh, wow.
Just tossed out, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yep, people don't know what they have, that's for sure. Well, the other question, too, is, and I guess I can take this question off the air, I was wondering if you could explain what is up with Andrew Jackson. I mean, on one hand, here's a guy, he's an avowed Mason, and on the other hand, you know, he's known for his last words being, "I killed the bank," and having a war. I mean, it's almost like, it seems to me that those two impulses are contradictory in him. What was Andrew Jackson all about from your research?
Andrew Jackson was an establishment man, there's no doubt about it. And I found a lot of these people, and this goes way back thousands of years. You read the story of the Emperor Julian and the sort of eulogy they give to him as he was dying. I think they put words into their mouths that they'd never speak to give them a different image. To be honest with you, that's what I find out. Because you say the guy was an establishment all along. He definitely went along with the program. You can't get up to that level without it. So to turn against the bank, I really can't figure that one out, you know. But we'd have to get one of the New Age channelers to get a hold of him.
Right, well, you know, I looked into him a little bit. I guess I was going to take this question off air, but his history was interesting, because I guess there was an anti-Masonic party that was actually quite big.
There was, and there was the Know Nothing party too, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of going machinations to do with Masonry after the Morgan affair. But that's it for tonight, folks. From Hamish, myself, Hamish is a dog, by the way, in Ontario, Canada, good night, and may your God, or your gods, go with you.